We're
recording this remotely today.
It sometimes happens.
It does. You've been massively busy as well because the football has all gone.
Football started. The problems have begun. A lot of what I like about football at the moment, there's a lot of transferable skills from when, like, the WWE misrepresents how many people are in a stadium. The Qataris and FIFA seem to be really into this sort of that sort of thing at the moment. And also despotic regimes, sports washing, everything.
Completely. And there is a funny thing about how you sort of realise that WWE is not mainstream, despite what they think and despite what they'd have you believe, because you realise they've done this four times now.
Yeah.
And when the World Cup does it once, everyone is like, this is a big issue. And, you know, WWE have been doing it for a long time. People have been criticising it, but no one at The Guardian's given a stuff. You know, nobody's writing op-ed Pete's about, you know, it's just, it is sad that wrestling is in such a sort of ridiculous cul-de-sac that they can do what the World Cup does for 4 years and nobody says anything.
I'm very happy that I can reuse the same material about religious fundamentalism being a bit gay in two different places at once. It's cracking stuff. And I was only reminded by the fact that it was on one of our YouTube videos quite recently. The old royal what was their royal show? The Saudi show.
Crown Jewel.
Crown Jewel, that's the one.
I think if there's anything on YouTube that we've done about the Middle East being a bit gay, I think we should take that down.
I said I'd fight
them. Have you met many people who are being all superior and sort of going, I'm not actually watching it, and you know that they've never even watched a football match in their life?
No, not in our space, because everyone makes all of their money out of literally reporting on the football, so it would be true. Astonishing to do that. I floated the idea of, I wonder if any sponsors would be into paying us money not to talk about the World Cup, and that was treated by certain members of my little collection as being a bad idea, which I think is shocking, to be quite frank.
Being paid not to talk is brilliant. That's a great idea.
Your dream.
That's what you get if you're a real pain in the arse, isn't it? You get paid to go away.
Please stop this. Yeah.
Really good. Oh man. Well, I've been watching some sort of live wrestling recently. I watched AEW's big pay-per-view that just went out, which I thoroughly enjoyed. Pete, nearly 5 hours.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is, I mean, I don't know how you watched it, but most people will have had to have paid for that. So you sort of think, well, they want value for money, but for people who live in Britain, it is a big pain in the fucking arse, isn't it?
It is. You can obviously watch it on the replays and things. Absolutely, you know, not worth doing, because as soon as you open your phone, you'll have a notification that says MJF wins belt. It's like, oh, you know, no spoilers of that. The first word, if it said AEW news, I might have got away with it. But the reality is, we've said this before, if you have anything approaching a normal life, you cannot watch 5 hours of something in even like 3 days. It's just too much. And I think it's because, like, Tony Khan has bought so many people, so many wrestlers, that you sort of go, I'm paying them all. They want to get out there. We can't hold them back. The fans will love it. And it's just too much. By the time it got to the end, I was really like, I hope this is 3 minutes. I really just hope they rattle through this and then we can all carry on with our lives. But I mean, that wasn't the case. It was a long slog, and it slightly put me off wrestling.
I'm glad we're doing the Hostile City Showdown from 1995 at a very, very soon on this show. But
in fairness, that actually brought me back in love with it.
Okay,
it's been a very quick turnaround.
But since the last recording, didn't you go and watch some wrestling in town as well?
That's right. I went to see Pro Wrestling Eve's Wrestle Queendom 5 at 229, which is a venue in Great Portland Street, part of a student union. One of the last sort of small size central London venues that isn't, like, you know, you can only hire it for a wedding of a Freud and a Murdoch, that sort of thing. It is just a little venue that I think bands might still sometimes play. I've certainly DJed there before. I think you've done quite a lot of DJing at 229. And it was really enjoyable just to have that sort of small room big ring, lots of people from all around the world. The brilliant thing that Eve does is they bring in a lot of the Japanese women performers. So people from Tokyo Joshi Pro, you get occasional people from, I think some Stardom people have been there. I might be wrong on that. But it was great. I went with Ross Pollard, who is a Pat Patronson. Sitting behind us was James, who is another Pat Patronson. Lovely to see those guys. And it was a thorough delight. I mean, you know, there's nothing like live wrestling. There just really isn't anything as enjoyable and delightful. Out came Chigusa Nagayo, the legendary Japanese performer of the Crush Girls, who did some singing, which was nice. There was a wrestler there who was called Yu, is her surname. And the crowd was singing "I Love You, Baby" very loud. And so Chigusa Nagayo joined in with that. But it's such a lovely, welcoming, warm crowd that you get at Pro Wrestling Eve. I really, really enjoy that. It's just a great night. The only thing was I'd had a mad period of work, so I couldn't go to the meet and greet after. And there's Chigusa Nagayo signing left, right and centre, anything you want. And I was heartbroken, Pete. I was actually heartbroken, but there we are. I can't recommend Eve enough. There was a wrestler there called Hyper Misao, who is a sort of Hurricane Helms style gimmick, but done by a Japanese woman in her early 30s. And right. She was one of my favourite wrestlers that I've seen all year. I think she's just the pure fun of pro wrestling. And very quickly, one of our Patreons said for WrestleMemus, here's a match with Hyper Misao versus Jun Kasai, the most frightening and bloodthirsty deathmatch wrestler in Japan. I've not watched it yet. I'm going to have a look at it and then decide if we do it for WrestleMemus. I might find it upsetting.
You find everything upsetting.
I've got a big heart and a lot of emotions. But what's PT been doing? What have you been doing? Have you just been, you know, watching the telly, the old footers.
What have I been doing? Yeah, I think I've just been doing that, to be honest. This is kind of the last time we... What was the last pay-per-view we did? I can't bloody remember. Oh, it was
Collision in Korea.
North Korea. It was Collision in Korea, yeah. That was boring, wasn't it? That was boring at times. So I have literally just been recovering from a boring pay-per-view, to be honest, in the last couple of weeks, and just getting a bit of work done, really.
Oh, nice. Can I ask, have you worn an England shirt at any point?
No. I did. I worked at a fan park, and I interviewed Teddy Sheringham and Peter... What's his bloody name? Goalkeeper.
Shilton.
Peter Shilton. And one I found utterly charming, and one I didn't find very charming. And you'll never guess which one I found charming. Peter Shilton, absolutely lovely, until I imagine he starts talking about anything political. Like your dad, though. Like, don't talk to your dad. Like, I know what I'm going to get out of my dad if I talk about a particular subject. So, you know, it's...
What are Teddy Sheringham's politics? I'm sure he's not made them clear, but I should imagine they aren't dissimilar.
No, I'm sure they're fine. He seemed quite nice, though. I mean, to be fair, he took the fact that I called him Terry Sheringham in front of 1,000 people twice. He took that in good grace.
It's not like you've not seen some football in your time.
I know. Because my D's, Teddy, are quite close together, I think. Terry versus Teddy. And, I did it once, and then I acknowledged it, and I went, sorry about that, Teddy. And then I overthought it, and then just did it again later on. And the second one was deliberate. Not deliberate, but like a genuine slip. And they were both genuine slips. I don't know. Yeah. They were just two very different mistakes that ended up in the same cul-de-sac.
Did the audience, did they begin to lose confidence in you? Did they think that you'd never seen football before?
Well, that's the thing, I've seen Teddy Sheringham play football. He was very good. He wouldn't have a chat with me about
that
football.
That sounds like someone who doesn't really know very much about... What can you tell me about Teddy Sheringham? Sheringham as well. See exactly what you've done. I'm not even going to pick you up on that little logic flaw that I thought I'd spotted there, because I'm just as bad as you are.
I think because you were talking about Ivan Toney. You wanted Ivan Toney to play in the squad, and he's a guy who... It clearly wasn't allowed to be in the squad because he was he's been accused of 200 flagrant breaches of the anti-betting rules. You can't bet on football if you're a footballer. That's how it works, Ivan.
It's not fair. Those are the only bets that I can influence.
And at the time of recording, Ivan, I don't know where that situation is, but he's certainly been accused of 230 breaches of it. Who knows what will happen there? But yeah, I mean, you have to make it clear you can't get up to that kind of shenanigans, and you know,
are you winking?
Hey, when the fun stops, stop. But Teddy Sheringham said, "Are you really like Ivan Toney?" I said, "Teddy, I'm glad that you said that, because I think in the whole England squad, he's the closest to how he used to play." And he went, "Do you?" though later on we were both eating the identical meatball marinara Subway sandwiches, and he went, "How's your sandwich, son?" I went, "It's very nice." He went, "Good, aren't they?" So he trusts me on sandwiches. He just doesn't trust me on
Get a connection with you before, but then he saw the matching sandwich and he went, "You know what? I've misjudged this lad." this lad is A-OK. It's a funny thing, you know, that thing about where you... When you make just like a couple of maybe small slips or whatever, people do sort of begin sort of going, "Does this guy know?" And I was just thinking about on the YouTube, there was someone who put a comment that just sort of said... it was thoroughly positive, and they were like, "When I first listened to this, I thought you guys were a big rip-off of OSW.
Yeah.
But as I've listened to a bit more, I can tell you know your wrestling." And I slightly have that thing about going, "Yeah, I do know my wrestling, mate. Yeah. I haven't been waiting for, like, you know, El Tony from the middle of Minneapolis to come and say, "Yeah, you've passed the El Tony test. El Tony thinks you do know a bit about wrestling." It's always very difficult. It's a hard thing to do when someone says, "Prove that that you're into something." Like prove that you like football. You know, it's a really difficult thing to do. And I think it's slightly the same with wrestling. And when people are on YouTube going through our stuff, that immediate thing of going, "Set themselves up to talk about wrestling, have they?" Well, we'll see.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a really horrible, horrible position to be in. Oddly, I think it was one of the things that we didn't get when we first did this podcast. And that's, I think, one of the things that was such a relief, that people weren't going like, "Oh my God, you don't know what you're talking about."
Well,
and considering you'd never seen any wrestling before, that is not a bad way to have done it.
What makes you laugh is like, there's nothing like interests that skew very male. To have like a fucking army of gatekeepers just sort of go, "Well, I don't think you do actually know much about it," you know, that sort of thing. But also, like, I think there's such a breadth of like maniacs out there that you will like meet your match when it comes to not meet your match, but like people will be criticizing you about stuff. And you will have independently come about a particular opinion about a particular match or a particular person. And also, those opinions were formed when we recorded those shows, sometimes nearly 3 years ago, effectively.
Yeah, completely.
So things have massively changed, and people do float around in the wind, really.
There is one person who's put comments on, I think we must have been doing like WrestleMania 2, and we were talking about King Kong Bundy. And that was recorded, you know, obviously right at the start when we began this, so 2018, at which point Bundy was still alive. Well, he's died in the interim. The video's gone up, and we're sort of going, "Isn't he good looking? I mean, he's actually quite good looking, you know, if he wasn't bald." And someone's like, "Dude, he's not good looking anymore. He's dead." And it's, yeah, I cannot go back to 2018. And you get one chance at time travel. I'm going to go back to 2018, to episode 3 of Wrestle Me, and I'm going to sort of put in a codicil where I say, "But if you're listening to this and he's dead, I imagine King Kong Bundy is decaying." Okay, well, let's make some errors that we can enjoy in future years.
Yes.
A little bit of ECW's Hostile City Showdown 1995. The reason I picked this one, Pete, is because this is exactly in the area that we've been doing for the last couple of months, which is 1995. And it's put there, really, so that you can see just how different ECW was in the entire wrestling landscape. So this year we've had WrestleMania 12. We've had SummerSlam 95 with the main event of Diesel versus King Mabel. We've had, we'll have Halloween Havoc 95 in WCW where there are two fighting monster trucks. We've had that awful uncensored triple cage match. And underneath it all is ECW, which is doing something unlike any of the other big two, and is basically, it's the hand thrown out by to every drowning fan. Every fan who is going under and just going, this is the worst wrestling has ever been. Suddenly, ECW's blood-soaked, barbed wire-wrapped hand shoots out, and it says, grab on, start drinking, you'll probably see some boobs. This is going to be all right. And watching this, Petey, I mean, this is not like a key ECW event. I picked it because it was happening in April, so just after WrestleMania. So we get an impression of sort of where they are, really, in terms of the year. But what really struck me is this show just, I mean, it threw me straight back to that moment where I found ECW and how ECW just cracked open that thing of going, wrestling is still for adults and it's for grown-ups and you can still enjoy it, you know, when you're 18, rather than, you know, having to watch Duke the Dumpster Drosy having his spade stolen by a pig farmer. How did you feel about this? Because I know you've seen some ECW, some really early 93 ECW in its first years, and you found it grimy and slightly depressing.
Yeah, I'm still trying to sort of figure out what separates the WWE or WCW's output to this. And it is, I don't know, I think it's just kind of like they're a bit looser with their characters in that, like, you can just wear what's perceived to be cool at any one time.
Yeah.
Like, it seems to be like normal clothes you could get away with on the metro, like, yes, dressing like the bloke out of Pearl Jam, and you can win with like leg drops and stuff, and it's just kind of like there are so many little surprises where you're like, oh, I didn't expect this to happen, and like the crowd look like the wrestlers and the wrestlers look like the crowd.
That's really true. There's that. I mean the crowd are really the most important performer in the whole of this show.
Yeah.
This is the perfect example of how ECW really sort of changed what a wrestling crowd was. Up until this point, we've never seen anything like this, where there's just, as you say, men that look like wrestlers. They are by and large men. They are by and large white men. They are really into it in a way that nobody's ever been into wrestling this much before. The small things really wind them up, but they also work as a weird sort of unit where my favourite thing is in the second match, they bring in a Japanese performer who's called Tsubo Genjin.
Yes.
And that was a name that he used just very briefly. And we will talk about that. It's only a short clip they show of it. But in that, the entire crowd make the decision to turn on him and to mock him and then to boo him out of the building. And the crowd in that moment, basically, they dictate the booking. They have worked as one to go, we do not, as a unit, want to see this. And so the crowd has become more powerful than the wrestlers. It's an amazing thing to watch. I had a look online and I was like, I'm fascinated with the building it's in. So the building it's in, it is still standing. It's called the 2300 Arena, or it's the letter, it's the numbers 2300.
Yeah.
And I don't know how they pronounce it. I don't know if they call it, it's the 2300 Arena. Don't know if it's the 2300 Arena, probably. I don't know if it's the 2300 Arena or the, I don't know, it could be any combination of this. But when I was thinking about the crowd being, like, you know, such a key part of the show, I'd actually been looking at the building, and there was someone who'd made a comment on it just saying, the building is as much an important part of ECW shows as anything else, because it had this unique atmosphere. It was like ECW insofar as it was in a sort of quite sort of, the building is a bit run down.
Yeah.
It's not very nice. It was in a really, really rough area. There are lots of people around taking drugs. That's seemingly what it seems like. But inside, you'd get inside. I was like, it's weird because you'd think everyone was really, really drunk.
Yeah.
And actually there was no bar. And I was looking at it and I was thinking, people aren't really drinking. There's not like loads of drinking going on. Occasionally people will sort of like pick up a little cup and have a sip, sip, sip. And I was like, what's going on? So I did a load of deep diving on it. And it turns out that it was bring your own booze for many years. So people used to have big tailgate parties outside the arena. And everyone would get drunk. They'd drink all their booze beforehand. Then they'd go into the venue and watch it. So I think they are quite pissed, the crowd. But they're pissed from the word go.
Yeah.
Which makes it really, really great. I found a guy who'd been going to ECW in about 95, 96, so at this time. And he'd written a thing where someone had said, what was it like going to ECW in the mid-90s? Mm. And his main thing was he talked about the atmosphere. So he said it was very electric and visceral. ECW felt like it was ours as it was a local promotion. Even when they got more popular and did shows out of state, we felt immensely proud of them. The crowd was a mix. You'd have the throwback South Philly Italian types, white trash, punks, metalheads, wrestling fans, college students, and a lot of blue-collar workers. It was a weird combination of metal, sort of house punk show, and strip club.
Okay.
I said the word strip there, emphasised it, forgot the word club on the end. So they say it's a bit like a metal or a house punk show. What's a house punk show, Pete?
It's just when you see really old-school punk rock bands playing in people's living rooms, basically.
Gotcha.
Pretty much.
But, that's what he's saying. And a strip club. He was like that. So they were talking about how the crowd made it a big social occasion. And again, these things have never really happened in wrestling before, where the crowd become really dedicated to those three letters, ECW. And they think of it as being theirs more than it's the wrestlers. Mm. That's a fascinating, weird thing that you cannot fake. Mm. I think to some groups, you know, it has happened. It did happen, I think, with Progress a bit at the start, where there was a group of people who very much felt like this was theirs. You know, they would obviously be on friendly terms with the wrestlers. They knew them from outside. Obviously, we know where that ended up going. But there were periods where that has sort of happened again. And that sense of a promotion becoming a group, a friendship thing that's owned by the fans is such a unique thing. And probably this is the first time that it actually happens. This is a really interesting time for ECW. I did have a quick look at some of the WWE stuff that they made, you know, the documentaries about it. And one of the things that I do feel is happening with ECW is the way that WWE has started retelling its history has made it seem very twee. I was watching a thing called The Authentic Untold Story of ECW, and that was where they got a load of, you know, Heyman, Taz, the Dudley Boys, and Tommy Dreamer. They sit down and they're sort of talking about it on a round table. And it's hosted by Corey Graves. And the opening that he does, he just sort of goes, I mean, there's a voiceover. ECW was a group of outlaws who spurred a revolution. From Sabu to RVD to Shane Douglas and Raven and many more, these rebels brought it to the extreme. And it's so the antithesis of what ECW was like. It's like someone, you know, that punk hardcore scene, it would be like someone just sort of saying, you know, Rancid Death were pushing the boundaries in a way that it's so the wrong
no,
tone.
No, they turned up in a reconditioned school bus that they thought was cool to hire, and they hadn't slept. They were on fucking PCP, and they were
exactly
you
dirty. You cannot.
And they just
hadn't
changed their socks in weeks.
You cannot have a thing saying these rebels brought it to the extreme when lots of them died of drugs overdoses, right? It's too much of a Disneyfication. I'm probably saying Disney. In that, Paul Heyman does mention around 1995, Disney almost bought 50% of ECW.
Right.
And had that happened, it would have been a real game changer. But it got really all the way to the top, at which point they went, we don't feel this is particularly Disney. And it all fell apart. But where ECW is at this point, they're 2 years into their history. Paul Heyman's been running them, and they have got, you know, just hot by word of mouth. The wrestling magazines love them because they have access to the shows, and they have, you know, very big sort of like exciting matches that you can put in a magazine to help it sell.
Yeah.
Barbed wire matches, you know, taped fist. It's all about the violence and the incredible sort of high flying off the balconies, through tables, all of that. They've built a very good brand. But really, the only way that you can access their shows, if you don't live in Philadelphia, is you have to buy it on VHS. And I have got a couple of original ECW tapes. You'd have to order them basically through things that you'd see in the back of wrestling magazines.
Right.
You'd get a paper white-sleeved VHS that had a printout on the front. And it was exactly the same as, you know, if you ordered pornography. There was absolutely no difference in the way that it looked. It was as basic as you can get. But if you were into wrestling, it was just treasure. You know, you knew what was on that tape was going to be so lurid and vivid and exciting, like pornography.
Yeah.
You know, it's just another world that can open up that you get in a very, very boring way. At this time in 1995, ECW nearly got pay-per-view. And it's a really interesting thing to imagine. They wouldn't get pay-per-view until 1997.
Mm.
But if they'd have got pay-per-view in 1995, when WWE and WCW were both struggling, there's a possibility that, you know, wrestling history could have been quite different. That ECW is never going to become the number one, but it could have survived a lot longer than it did. It could have kept the stars that it made, who would pretty much all just go to WWE and WCW as soon as the money, you know, dried up in ECW.
Yeah.
And they could have gone on longer, and they probably would have been a stronger force. Whether, you know, I mean, it's just, it's impossible to say what would have happened. The reality is, had they got more money, they may have just spent more, and more people would have died of drugs overdoses. But at the time, what had happened is UFC had set up pretty much the same month and year, September 93, as ECW did. And UFC had been on pay-per-view, and it was beginning to attract sort of negative attention. Senator John McCain had come forward and called it a barbaric form of human cockfighting. And the pay-per-view distributors began saying, well, we don't really want to get involved with this. And
yeah,
they begin dropping it. And at the time when Heyman is saying, I've got this pro wrestling, and showing people at pay-per-views to try and get it so that they can sell it, you know, in bi-monthly big shows, everyone is saying, but this is extreme fighting, and they're confusing it with UFC.
Yeah.
And it's too bloody and it's too aggressive. So they all pull out, and Heyman doesn't manage to get pay-per-view. Instead, he's running it on a shoestring. He's borrowing money off his parents. I think in total he borrowed $4 million off his mum and dad in the course of the promotion's existence.
I do not want to know how old Paul Heyman's mum and dad looks. If Paul Heyman looks like that at that age, don't want to see
it. I know, but having to give this man child, I mean, $4 million as well. I mean, well done them.
Paul Heyman
does say that in the story as well. He does sort of just go out, you know, do you know how much they ended up lending me? $4 million. I go, well, nice, good for you.
Good for you. I mean,
that seems like a lot.
Yeah, it does seem like a lot. I mean, yeah, I guess all of the, every sort of big thing that we've ever enjoyed has started like that, isn't it, really?
Isn't it? Look, if my parents could lend me $4 million, I could buy so much wrestling merch, and in, 3 years, it would be virtually worthless. I'm not saying this is a reason why we shouldn't do it, Mum and Dad. If you were WCW or WWF, you are at this time as well beginning to go, we're losing a lot of fans. People don't seem to like our product. We're directing it at kids, and yet we're losing, you know, the traditional fan base. If you're struggling like they are, you're beginning to see some signs at your shows that say ECW fucking rocks and stuff, and you're hearing about this promotion set up by the former Paulie Dangerously from WCW that people seem to be really into, that is hot and people are talking about.
Yeah.
And so they are beginning now to look at ECW. And the horror is WWF and WCW are not providing anything like ECW are doing, and they aren't connecting with their fans in the way that ECW are. But ECW have less money than those two. And so what will happen is, just as soon as people really showcase themselves in ECW, WCW and WWF are waiting to swoop in. So by the end of this year, the people that we see on this show, including Eddie Guerrero, Dean Malenko, Raven and Public Enemy, they will all be leaving for WCW.
Right.
And in 1996, ECW will start doing angles on WWF TV. They are desperate for a little bit of the rub of the cool promotion. So it's a thrilling time to be in ECW that at the time they wouldn't have known was completely unsustainable and ultimately meaningless. Wow. So let's have a look at the very, very first match. So this took place on the 15th of April, 1995, in the ECW Arena in Philadelphia, the now renamed 2000 Club, whatever it is. The first match, Mikey Whipwreck versus Steven Richards. Petey, what do you think about these two new faces?
These two new faces. Let's have a look. I mean, the thing that confuses me is that this sort of match rolls. I don't know. Is that the pay per view where it's fault, or is it the actual how they've edited it? It kind of winds into
the next quickly.
Match. Yeah,
yes, they do.
Yeah, they start quickly, and then so I wasn't really sure where it had all kind of started. It's like,
because these are video cassettes, they're made for video. They aren't going out in other than on TV in the Philadelphia area.
Officially, are they?
So
right?
Yeah, so they have. This has been edited for the videotape,
right?
And presumably, the original filming is long gone. It does seem to be filmed on a camcorder,
yeah,
that probably just had a video go straight into
Stevie Richards looks like Pat Sharp off his head at a Heart FM roadshow. Like, he looks so much like Pat Sharp, and he's kind of like dressed a bit like Raven a little bit, I guess. He's kind of
supposed to be emulating Raven, who Raven is almost like a dark cult leader at this point, and he's got what, Raven's Nest, which is it would later in WCW he'd be called Raven's Flock, and that does make sense. But it's a perfect example of just going, Raven, it's a bird, what's a bird, or nest, we'll do Raven's Nest. Do you want to do, well, it's Raven's Nest, it's Raven's Peck, or it's Raven's White and Black Poo.
Yeah, okay.
What would you prefer? Right, okay, I think Nest. We'll go with Nest. He does. Stevie Richards has a look as well of when, like, sportsmen dress up as women for, like, local fundraisers, that sort of thing. So when they dress up as, like, a Spice Girl, he's got the look of that.
Yeah.
This unbelievably big, shaggy hair. 1995, Pete. 1995.
Yeah,
and Stevie Richards is rocking that.
It's kind of like, but like, I think belly tops are sort of coming back a little bit for boys. You sort of see him sort of kicking around, but I'm not against it. I mean, I can't get involved right now because I'm painfully overweight. But
well, they've done it with Stevie Richards wears that. The other member of Raven's Nest at this point is the Blue Meanie, and the Blue Meanie does wear a little tiny crop top with his great big, lovely, soft, sort of doughy belly coming out. And so he got away with it. You know, people talk about what a good look that was still to this day on this podcast. It's little Mikey Whipwreck against him. And Mikey Whipwreck was a character who they it was a good piece of Paul Heyman booking, which was, you make him the perennial underdog, but you also have him be a really, really good wrestler. And so he was small, but he had a fighter's heart, and he would ultimately, he would win the ECW world title.
Yeah.
And so he was a perennial one that the crowd got behind. What Paul Heyman did very cleverly was he didn't really reinvent the wheel when it came to wrestling. He just used all the things that had been done so well for years, and he made them look modern.
Mm.
So Mikey Whipwreck is just a character who, you know, he's plucky, and, you know, you can see him. He feels like a 1940s thing, a plucky young guy who's got so much heart and moxie. He will ultimately triumph in the end. And he does. He comes out with Hack Myers, who was known as Shaw, and I think he was called Shaw because he used to make a noise when he punched people. He used to go Shah, Shah, Shah. So they began calling him the Shaw. People would make that noise when he did punching. Another example of the crowd determining booking effectively. They heard Shaw, they pick up on it. One person picks up on it, then everyone joins in. And then they have created someone's gimmick, which is a lovely thing. The idea of a crowd actually, you know, booking effectively by their responses.
Yeah.
This was a fine match. I mean, it was quite redundant of a lot of ECW, which was they would have these perfectly decent matches about, you know, characters that you were fond of but not wild about, in matches that you didn't mind seeing. They would be, you know, well wrestled. They would end, you would cheer, and you'd never ever think of it again.
Yeah.
There's a little bit here where they end it with a load of people, the Public Enemy and the Pitbulls, running into the ring and just all having a knockabout. And that is what the fans are there to see. So it's almost like they've gone, you were very polite to sit through that match. Don't worry, here is some knocking about and some chaos.
Well, I think
just to keep you calm.
I think in the Axel Rotten versus Ian Rotten in the barbed wire baseball bat match a little later on, like the commentators at one point shout, I'll be damned, some wrestling. It's kind of that's the kind of feeling. I this is all so new compared to all of the other stuff that I've kind of watched before. It is kind of a little bit hard for me to sort of judge what this is, because until they start knocking shit out of each other outside of the ring, there's not a lot of stuff that I've seen before, really.
No, and I mean, what's sort of interesting about ECW is it is always seen as being, oh, it's this hardcore and outlaw promotion and everything. Yeah. But it did also cater to people who really liked wrestling. Mm. It wasn't all blood and violence. It was quite a lot of the time not just state-of-the-art wrestling, but world wrestling. And so, you know, you do see later in this show, you get a match between Eddie Guerrero and Dean Malenko, which is the type of match that would never have been put on by WWF or WCW, really, at any point in their history. They just wrestle this beautiful, timeless style. Both men, second generation wrestlers, their fathers had been huge stars from the 60s onwards.
Yeah.
And so they came with all this knowledge and learning of wrestling, and they put them in front of that ECW crowd, and the crowd cannot get enough of it. They lap it up. ECW was, even though it has the word extreme at the top, it has the word wrestling at the end, and they were serious about wrestling. That point would work better, Pete, if it wasn't also for the fact that, like, WWE and WCW all have the word wrestling in it. They all do have the word wrestling in. But it's always a funny thing that people focus on extreme, because I suppose no one else was doing that.
Yeah.
And what they don't focus on is how ECW did so many different types and styles of wrestling within a single show. Just really because, you know, it was there for wrestling fans. It was. Oh, I mean, when we get to the Guerrero Malenko, I mean, that's a transcendent piece of work. First of all, we've got the second match, which is Tsubo Genjin versus Tony Stetson. Two men, Pete, that are history is totally forgotten. Absolutely, just forgotten men. It'll be. I mean, I imagine if you said, you know, you met Tony Stetson and he'd say, oh, he's an ECW, you'd just go, oh, the fucking loser. You know, why lie? Why lie about something so obvious that you can check so quickly? This is just a tiny clip, and I think this was very much a case of what they did on video. Tsubo Genjin and Tony Stetson are not going to sell any videotapes, so there's no point giving them 20 minutes on here.
Right.
Just a little tiny clip, but this is a perfect example of where the crowd make up their mind as to what's going to happen.
Yeah.
So Tsubo Genjin is not well known by any means. He is a Japanese performer. His real name is Hiroyoshi Kotsubo. And again, that isn't a name that you go, oh gosh, that, oh, he turned into that, didn't
he? Yeah, okay, yeah.
Completely unknown pretty much in everything. He's still working today, but on a very, very sort of low level. He's done some New Japan matches, but nothing sort of like major. He was in this gimmick as Tsubo Genjin. He's wearing some sort of like Jimmy Superfly snooker trunks, and he's got Kiss style makeup, and he's Japanese. And normally with fans like this, because they love wrestling, anyone Japanese, they'd be like, oh, this is an exciting honour. Let's see what this guy has to offer. And clearly, in the match, Tsubo Genjin has done nothing that's good. Because when they cut in, the crowd are just mocking him. They're openly mocking him. He makes a screeching sound when he does one move. And the crowd just all starts screeching back at him. Going, and he does it again. They go, and I said, the noise that he makes them angry.
Yeah.
And they get angry. They're really angrily shouting it back. And I was watching this and I was a bit like, do they hate this or are they really
into
playing
it,
along?
Yeah.
Oh, God, and it ends. He pins Tony Stetson with a knee drop. And it ends, and the crowd are just on their feet, and they are screaming at him,
yeah.
And they are giving him the finger, and they are absolutely incandescently offended that he has put on whatever match he's put on. And it's amazing to watch. The crowd are furious. They are so slighted by what he's done. It was incredible. The ECW fans, by doing that as well, will have dictated what happened to Tsubo Genjin, which is they were saying, we don't want to see you again. And indeed, he'd be brought back one more time as part of a tag team called the Oriental Connection. That's not aged well. They'd lose a short tag team match. But it's fascinating watching them really get offended by the match that's been put in front of them.
Yeah.
So exciting. Tony Stetson, he was a guy who... He was almost like the sort of the first person people would face when they came to ECW. He'd been around for a few years in the same territory. So ECW came out of Eastern Championship Wrestling. Eastern Champion Wrestling, in turn, came out of a thing called Tri-State Professional Wrestling. And he'd been part of that. So he was just one of those guys who just put in a lot of hours. And I think they sort of had him around out of a sort of loyalty.
Yeah.
The thing I like about him is he had two different nicknames. One was Tough Tony Stetson, and the other is Tony the Hitman Stetson. By 95, Hitman is very much a gone gimmick. You can't call yourself that. That's Bret Hart's. You know, it's a bit too obvious. You cannot in 95 go, I've come up with a new nickname. I'm going to call myself the Hitman. It's an indication there as to why Tony Stetson didn't make it over the years. And then match number three, Petey, we had Axel Rotten versus Ian Rotten.
Ian Rotten. There's not as many Ians in wrestling as there should be, I think. I do think that. It's it just makes me... It's just like Axel... one of the commentators shouts, Axel, raking the barbed wire across the head of Ian. It just doesn't sound right.
Well, I mean, Ian is a kayfabe name, and it was chosen because to Americans, I think Ian and Kevin, maybe not Kevin so much nowadays, but Ian is very much the most English of names.
Right, okay.
That doesn't really exist outside of Britain. Now, I say that seems like a dangerous thing to say, because I know everyone's going to go, well, what about Ian Saint-Pierre of France, you know, and there'll be a lot of that. But I believe the Americans do choose Ian a lot. Ian and Nigel is the other one,
right?
Because of I think more because of Spinal Tap, I think Nigel becomes quite a popular one. But Axel was he gave himself, when he started, a punk gimmick, and he chose his name, Axel from Axl Rose and Rotten from Johnny Rotten.
Right.
But, I mean, Axel's real name is Brian. So, again, that's sort of a more British-sounding name than Axel.
And he's got the word Ian in it.
Yes, he does. Gosh, I wonder if Ian is a shortened version of Brian.
Yeah.
Like an unexpected shortening.
Two Ians. You know? Inexplicably two Ians in there.
But Axel Rotten starts off in the independents in America in the late 80s, and he actually trained Ian Rotten. So Ian Rotten was one of the few people who he helped out. Ian Rotten's real name was John Williams, and he was from Kentucky. But Axel Rotten wanted to do this punk sort of brothers tag team, so he was renamed Ian Rotten, and together they were a tag team called Bad Breed. They were billed in their early days as being Pete from Newcastle.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Yeah.
You never get a mention.
Well, until Pac came along and became, you know, the famous wrestler from Newcastle, you know, there was no representation. But I believe in their 1991 WCW run, they had a very brief run as a sort of preliminary tag team.
Yeah.
I do believe that it's someone in WCW in the middle of nowhere, continually night after night, just saying, from Newcastle, England.
Yeah. I guess, I mean, it should be used more because it's got the word castle in it, for crying out loud. I mean, it sounds like
Newcastle.
A different place.
Yeah. I did a question for a quiz show about Newcastle, about the fact that there was an old castle.
Right,
so
okay. That's nice.
Why it became known as Newcastle. I mean, English, you sort of go, people aren't very thoughtful, are
no,
they?
No, no. They say what they
say. What should we call this town? Well, we've built a new castle. Let's call it Newcastle.
It's WYSIWYG.
Let's
what
call
you
it
say
Big
is what you
Tesco.
Get.
Yeah. Big Tesco. 15 years from now, mate. 15 years from now, that's what they'll be called. Big Amazon warehouse. No union rights. welcomes you. So they have their brief run, Bad Blood, and they come to ECW because they've met Paul Heyman in WCW back in the day, and he sort of liked them. He liked the sort of the moxie that they had, and they were brought in to ECW as a tag team, and they worked together for a couple of years as a high profile sort of, you know, pair. The reason they were high profile is because they do fulfill the quota of ECW's violence. They give that extreme stuff. They are more than happy to get bust open and bleed and go through tables and stuff. If you were being unkind, you would say that was slightly because both of them lacked the ability to wrestle particularly well. It is worth saying, I mean, Axel Rotten, while he looks sort of like, he looks like a pro wrestler.
Yeah.
Ian Rotten, I mean, he looks like shit. He looks like a really greasy baby. And he's disgusting. Like, he's the colour. When I was looking at him, I was like, what is he the colour of? And he's sort of the colour of, like, carpet dirt, and he's just he looks like he sort of, you know,
if you've
like
got,
smell
if you've
of
got,
old cigarettes.
If you've got a dog, specifically a Border Terrier, and you do the washing, there'll always be dog hair that's kind of amalgamated on the lip of the grey rubber, vulcanized rubber
that's
kind
Ian
of seal.
Rotten's
that's Ian
face.
Rotten. That's Ian's rotten face. Yeah. Ian's rotten face.
Well, they have this long tag team run in ECW where they, you know, are doing very, very well. But they lose a match, I think, to the Pitbulls, where the losing team has to break up. And as they break up, Ian Rotten turned on Axel. And then they went into a long series of violent hardcore matches against each other that were so sort of high profile at the time that they were voted Feud of the Year, Ian and Axel Rotten, in Pro Wrestling Illustrated, which was the big sort of mainstream mag. And so it was great, great publicity that they'd been in so many of the magazines with their violent matches and their glass fist matches and, you know, their table matches and dog collar matches, that they had actually sort of got a national reputation, the two of them, within wrestling. This match, I mean, it's pretty fun.
Yeah.
You want to say it's crap, and you want to say that, you know, the weird thing is most wrestling you watch, you go, oh, you can see the seeds of it here, but we do it much better nowadays. And I was watching this and going, oh, this is a better death match than anything that I've seen in the last, you know, 15 years. It was so fast and fun and violent, and Axel Rotten was good. He was really good at selling it and, you know, looking like he was still doing the business of professional wrestling. Ian Rotten is just walking around, like, you know, he just continually is trying to walk around the ring, and he gets, like, beat, you know, a barbed wire bat on the back of his head, and he'll get up and he'll just start trudging again, and Axel will hit him on the back, and then he'll go around the front and hit him on the front. But Ian Rotten's big thing is he just wants to walk around the ring again and again in peace.
Yeah.
And someone keeps deathmatching him up. It's slightly disappointing in that Ian Rotten is still going, and he did become the person who basically would control death matches through his promotion IWA Mid-South. And so the if you like, the progression of death matches went down the I trudge around the ring and don't really react very well Ian Rotten route, and not down the sort of let's give them a big show and let's do big faces of Axel Rotten. I enjoyed this. It came at just the right time. I'd seen the Mikey Whipwreck match, which was fine. I'd seen the Tsubo Genji match, which I loved and was like, this is exciting and no one's talked about it. And then we got to this hardcore match and I was like, ah. But then when it started, I was going, do you know what? I'm really into this. This is fun. It was it was fun, and it was violent, and it was just silly old shit, and I loved it.
It was silly.
I really
did like
it.
Silly old shit is a really, really good way of describing it. Because silly old shit is fun. We all came from it.
Axel would continue working with ECW until the very late 90s. I think he left in 1999. Mm. And he would then go into the indies. He never made the jump, like so many wrestlers from ECW, into WCW, or, you know, fewer of them, into WWF. He had a slow decline professionally, as a lot of these ECW guys did, but he had a swift decline personally, really. He was sort of infamous for being a very, very heavy drug user.
Right.
In 2005, when WWE brought back ECW, because they basically bought the archives, and really seen a resurgence of interest in it by a generation who'd grown up with it, forgotten about it, and then wanted to see more. Mm. They did bring Axel Rotten back for a few performances. He was on Raw, and he did some dark matches, but they never ended up signing him. And that slightly suggests that there were issues about him that they were concerned with.
Yeah.
In his later years, he would be confined to a wheelchair due to a spinal injury, and he lived in a rehab centre. He was trying to get clean. He was found dead in 2016 in February by police in a McDonald's bathroom in a place called Linthicum in Maryland. And an autopsy had showed that his death was due to a heroin overdose.
Right.
So a sad end for Axel Rotten. For Ian Rotten would leave ECW in late 95. He went back to Kentucky and he set up a pro wrestling hotline where he talked to wrestling fans about wrestling.
Oh, right, okay.
And he noticed that lots of the people from Kentucky who would ring were saying, "I'm sick of this USWA Jerry Lawler shit. I want some of this real wrestling, like ECW." So Ian Rotten decides to set up his own promotion called IWA Mid-South. And that becomes the key deathmatch organization outside of ECW. IWA Mid-South becomes far more gruesome, and it takes it to the next level. But what it does is it doesn't have any money. Ian Rotten is still going, so I'm not going to say that he's a crook or a promoter, although certainly there are people over the years who have said he is both a crook and a bad promoter. But he would bring in new talent, or just people who were not very talented, to take part in these matches, which you could only really get over by having them be tremendously gory. Mm. So there was very little skill, and there was very much violence and bloodletting and sort of grotesquery. He would sort of have a long career promoting those sorts of shows, and he is still going. You can look on his Wikipedia. It's really worth clicking on the look at the edited version, and you can see all the bits that he's clearly deleted, which are eye opening. So that is the little story of what happened to the Rotten brothers from Newcastle.
Oh.
Ian Rotten lived, but I mean, I wouldn't say it was any more dignified than, you know, poor Axel's end, really. It's all a bit grim and grotesque. And those guys really became, I suppose, the standard bearers of ECW. I like to remember it as a place where Eddie Guerrero and Dean Malenko could practice their art.
Mm.
But I think most people will remember it as being a place where, you know, Axel Rotten got barbed wire around his head while Ian Rotten hit him with a chair. Repulsive.
Absolutely disgusting.
Oh, well, look, we're going to be back next week. We're going to rattle through the rest of this show, because you know what December means, Pete.
Oh,
you know what December
it's
means.
It's upon us. It comes around so quick. Just over a week away from the bloody thing, and it's WrestleMemes.
Thank God they didn't move the World Cup to what has traditionally been the hardest time for us to get all our shows
exactly
done.
To get into a studio. But never mind, we'll figure it out.
We will, and I've picked some absolute doozies this year. I've picked stuff that when I've written it down, I've chuckled to myself about how pleased I am we're doing it. There is going to be some absolute bangers of shows. I'm really, really looking forward to it.
Lovely stuff.
I simply can't wait.
No, me neither. Always my favourite part of the year. Always my favourite section.
Yay.
Definitely. Yay. Lovely old job.
Well, look, we'll get through Hostile City Showdown 95. I would say, actually, out of all the shows that we watched recently, I would say go and watch this one.
Yeah, well worth a little peek.
I really enjoyed it. It just takes you back, doesn't it? Takes you back. It felt like watching old home movies. Although, ironically, I wasn't really watching it at the time. I'd probably started work.
Yeah.
And I think I was just like, still living at home,
right,
watching this on, like, you know, second generation copied videos. I mean, it's not glamorous,
no,
but it's the truth.
And you wouldn't tell anyone at the age you were then that you were doing that either. So that's
No. I'd wait till I was nearly 50 and had done all right before I went to that.
Oh,
hey, all right then, chipmunks. We will see you next week. Thank you very much for your support. We love you. That's we're going to leave it there.
Ta-ta. Farewell.
Bye.